Hi, everybody. Welcome to Read Science, where my co-host Jeff and I talk with popular science book authors about how they make their topics so compelling and engaging and make the world a little bit smarter about science. And I'm Joanne Manister, a blogger at Scientific American and Science Goddess on Twitter. And we are joined today by the author and photographer of several great books, Theodore Gray and Nick Mann, and I'll just show the books really quickly. So many of you may be aware of the book The Elements, the lovely coffee table book The Elements, which I've reviewed a few times, and perhaps you know the book Mad Science, which I have also reviewed. He has a follow-up to this, which actually I don't think I have, but today we're going to focus on the new book, Molecules. And so I'm really glad you all could be here to join us. We do have a question and answer application that you could ask questions and our guests will answer. So I'm going to turn it over to Jeff to introduce our first guest, Tao.
And I understand that the book Molecules was just arriving in bookstores this past Tuesday. So Tao is out busy promoting the book, and I hope that goes well. And I understand that there is soon going to be an app for Molecules as well. Tao Gray is a chemist and quite apparently obsessed by the periodic table of elements, literally a table. He has a story to tell about that. For 10 years, he wrote a monthly column for popular science magazine called Gray Matter about things related to chemistry, as far as I could tell, like cooking and blowing things up. Many of my friends will be very delighted to know that he's involved with an embroidery automation company called Pale Gray Labs. He was a partner in creating Touch Press, an app producer, and the publisher for the apps for The Elements and Molecules. And he was a co-founder of Wolfram Research. And I found in looking for this information that we share at least one thing, which is having had our lives changed by reading Oliver Sacks' memoir, Uncle Tungsten. Welcome to the show, Tao.
Hi.
Back to you, Joanne.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Tao, for joining us. Tao is actually right here in town at Wolfram Research, so of course I'm based at the University of Illinois. His photographer, Nick Mann, is also based here in Champaign-Urbana area, and you know, he's had a run-in with my oldest son, even though they probably don't remember this. But for Nick, Nick is best known as the photographer of The Elements, a visual exploration of every atom known in the universe. He grew up and lives in Urbana. In addition to his work with Tao Gray, he has an ongoing personal project of photographing the world, sculpture, architecture, and landscapes in 3D. And outside of photography, his main interest is mountain biking. And I'm just looking at, so here on Read Science, we really, really like to include a lot of people who are involved in creating a book because it's seldom an solitary effort on the author's part. So Nick, since I just introduced you, why don't you say hi? And my first question is going to go to you.
Hello, thanks for having us.
And Nick is sitting in his studio today. So, I briefly had a discussion with Nick yesterday as we were testing for the Hangout, and I was curious, how did you and Tao hook up to get to start taking pictures of these elements? And if I remember correctly, you were not thinking of a book initially. So why don't you tell us the backstory, and then Tao, feel free to jump in and embellish on the facts that Nick's going to share with us.
Right. Well, so I guess around 2006, Tao already had the element, was already collecting elements, and he brought me in because his hobby was getting out of hand. I think Tao might, he should tell the beginning of the story because I don't actually come in. It starts and then I come in a few years later.
The question though is how did I run into you? And basically you were kind of, I think, that it was described as homeschooled, but I would really describe it more like feral. you were kind of teaching yourself photography, and I needed some photography done because I had all these elements and couldn't deal with getting them all photographed. And So we just kind of started working together, and every, you know, like every year after we had finished some project and gotten a little money maybe and had some success with it, I always told Nick, like, this is not a real job. You know, this is not a future for you. You can't expect this to continue because that was you know, a flash in the pan, and it's not going to go on like this, and I don't actually have work for you. And every single time that I say that, you know, something else comes along. We did the book, and then we did the app, and, you know, and now Nick is working for TouchPress, my app publishing company, photographing all kinds of things. He was just in London like a week ago, and it's just kind of snowballed, and we just found out there's a, you know, yet another big project that we're going to need to work on, and it's like I can't get rid of this job because it just keeps coming back with you know, more unusually bigger projects to be worked on. Yeah, so Nick kind of just fell into this and turned out to be incredibly good at it and is now kind of, you know, absolutely, I mean, definitely the world expert on photographing elements, but pretty much also the world expert on photographing anything that rotates. Our specialty is kind of doing these interactive rotations for apps where you can spin an object on a turntable. And there's lots of people that have done that, but Nick does it more beautifully by far than anybody else. We have a lot of specialized equipment that we've developed and techniques for photographing and for lighting and for processing files that allows us to do this just really better than anybody else. And that's largely Nick's work.
Thank you. Yes. Teo holds me to very high standards, so that, yes, that is part of it.
So if you can't get the app, I know you have a video out there where you've taken Tom Lehrer's song on the elements, and that includes images of the rotating elements, some of the work you did. And in fact, they use that as a trailer for this program. So
right, we've ended up deploying those rotating images in a bunch of different places. I mean, they're in the app, and there you can spin them with your finger, and it's kind of cool. But you, for example, if you're in Philadelphia, you can go to a place called the Chemical Heritage Foundation. They have this huge 19-foot-high video wall that is basically playing a continuous loop of rotating elements like that, arranged into a little 12-minute program. And you know, where it came in very handy that we had this very high-resolution photography of lots of rotating elements, and that, you know, we've got displays like that of different kinds in various different places, and we license it the images to TV shows and, you know, publications of all sorts. Because if you want, like rare earths, for example, are in the news these days. You hear a lot about rare earths and their short supply and et cetera, et cetera, and you know, if you're a TV producer looking for something to put on your show to do with, you know, strontium or not strontium, but, you know, lanthanum or something, or cerium or whatever, you very quickly run into us, and you very quickly discover that there really isn't anybody else that's got anything like that. So we end up getting that business.
Speaking of pictures of elements, here's a simple question that came to mind. And I said it says something about the pictures and about your approach to the book, too. This is something you wrote very early on. I have this as page 10. You say, this sodium has been made into the shape of a duck for absolutely no reason, which I thought was a pretty powerful explanation of why it was in the book. But the question that came to mind then was, how do you arrive at what things are going to represent what thing that you're talking about? Because there are a lot of very interesting, odd, and sometimes unusual choices. There's the duck.
There's two related problems. In the case of elements, the problem is that they're all gray metals with almost no exceptions. And in the case of molecules, they're all white powders with very few
exceptions. Which I hope to talk about at more length in a minute.
And it's almost a defining characteristic of you having a pure compound that it's white. It's kind of like one way of telling purity in most cases, unless it happens to be, you know, one of this very small number of dye type, you know, colored molecules. So it's, you know, right off the bat, you have to give up on the idea of just showing a lump of each thing in its pure, straightforward form. There's, you know, Time Life published a periodic table like that with in the 60s, and it was nice, but it was 90-plus gray medals one after the other, and it just sort of lacks. So that, you know, that I took that as the initial challenge, is find something different and interesting. And, you know, in the case of a sodium duck, I mean, that's just a shoo-in, because, of course, the thing that you do with sodium is you throw it in a lake, because it explodes on contact with water. So, you know, if you have a duck made out of sodium, you know, and that was not my idea. That was a dental student in Phoenix, Arizona, I believe, who for whatever reason made a sodium duck and sent it to me.
Well, that's wonderful, because so you have interaction with the public that inspires your book then.
Yeah, I get offers of stuff periodically. In fact, there's a guy that's just offered me some counterweights from 747s that are made of depleted uranium, which is marvelous stuff. Mm. But I can't accept them because they weigh more than 15 pounds, and that would be illegal. So probably going to have to turn them down.
While we're on that subject, then, can we go ahead and finish with my question about the curse of the white powder? Why? And I was very interested, because I hadn't known, and I'm sorry, it was something useful that I learned from the book about why most of these powders that would be of interest are white to begin with.
Well, so chemically speaking, why they're white? I mean, it's because, by and large, you know, something can be colored only if it absorbs light of one color more strongly than another. If it either absorbs no light at all or absorbs all light equally, then, you know, it'll basically be either white or black. And it turns out that, you know, the range of wavelengths of light that correspond to the entire spectrum that we're able to see is pretty narrow. So it's kind of difficult chemically to arrange something which doesn't either absorb everything or nothing. And as it happens, because you have to kind of hit the middle of this very narrow band that we call visible light, and chop off a bit of it, but not the rest. And it turns out that most chemical bonds and most sort of, you know, organic molecules that you see, you know, occurring, you know, that are molecules of interest, most of the bonds are simply too strong, and the electrons are bound too tightly to allow visible light to knock them out of place. Mm-hmm. You need higher energy light, which would be, for example, ultraviolet light, which has more energy per photon, to break those bonds, or not necessarily break the bonds, but to kick the electrons out and therefore allow the light to be absorbed. And that's both why most of these sorts of molecules are white, because they don't absorb any light, and why ultraviolet light is harmful, because it's actually powerful enough to start knocking electrons out and therefore start damaging organic molecules like the ones in your skin or your eyes or wherever.
Yeah. All those white powders certainly do have a certain sameness to them, but they do look awfully good on Nick's black turntable.
That's a great
job. We really made an effort to find things that were not black powder or white powders that would kind of, you know, represent the substance without actually being the pure substance in its boring form. And that's also why there's an entire chapter about colors and pigments and things like that. That's, you know, basically just an excuse to have stuff in there that's
in colors.
Yeah. One of the challenges but while they're all white, they have different textures to them. So with a lot of the white powders, what I tried to do was get really close and light them so that you could see that they're still different. Like, some of them would really clump up, some of them would be extremely fine. Some of them had small crystals, some of them didn't. And so they do still look a little bit different. But yeah, all white, lots of white.
Yeah, so that takes some talent to differentiate them. And it shows. These pictures are gorgeous. When you were working with these things, were you in protective gear? Do you have your goggles and gloves and a face mask?
Most of them are completely benign. Like, we have a lot of sugars and different sweeteners in there, and that's just benign. But there were some other things where you just didn't want to inhale it, you didn't want to get it on your skin, so, yeah, protective equipment.
There was one in particular, and I can't recall offhand, but it was the rolled up sheets of something made from asbestos? Was it asbestos?
Yeah, it's asbestos shelf liners.
Yeah, that you said was the one thing that, that concerned you as you were placing it on the turntable, that it would, it felt dangerous.
Yes, I made Teo place that on the turntable.
Yeah, Nick has a thing about asbestos, and, you know, I guess I do too. It's kind of, you know, there's a lot of reasons not want to expose yourself to antique asbestos objects that are shedding. I just got an object which I so wish we had had in time to put in the book. But so it turns out, you know how cigarettes used to be healthy and good for you and doctors recommended mm-hmm. them? And then at some point it was decided that that was actually mistaken, well, not to have a filter to, you know, you should smoke through a filter. And so that's what they made those filters out of initially.
Oh, my gosh.
So, oh, yes.
So I actually managed to get on eBay a Air Force One presidential commemorative pack of Kent cigarettes with asbestos filters in them. So it's like you're smoking through asbestos on an airplane. It's like, you know, of all, it's like the, that's an object of its time.
Yeah, it was a much different time, wasn't it?
Now I'm starting to think my dad did actually die from emphysema, but he could have as easily had lung cancer, right, from the time he was smoking cigarettes. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's a little scary. I shouldn't laugh, but oh, my goodness. So you have to decide what you're putting in the book, get the images processed, but then you lay everything out. So who helps do this? This part, do you have a large part in this in saying?
Well, so the book layout was done primarily by Matt Coakley.
I know Matt.
Really?
Popular Science.
Yeah, right. No, yeah, he's that's where I first started working with him. Is he laid out my column in Popular Science for years until he left, and my, you know, if you look at the 10 years of that column, you can tell where he was there because they're just more beautiful, I think. And after he left, you know, he'd done the Elements book, and I really, really wanted him to do the Molecules book. And generally the way it works is, you know, I initially just, you know, throw the stuff at him. He just gets a whole bunch of text and a whole bunch of pictures, and I say, you know, just lay it out for purely for the sake of beauty, and I'm not even going to tell you which ones are important or insignificant or whatever. Just do it aesthetically, and then go through, you know, line by line, page by page, and fix all of the things that didn't come out right doing that. Because, you know, in some cases, it's really necessary for certain things to be in a certain order, and you wouldn't know that unless you kind of read the text in detail. Or maybe, you know, there's some object which isn't the most beautiful thing in the world, but it's by far the most important one, and it really needs to be bigger. And so, you know, so we go through and kind of adjust it for meaning and comprehension and sensibleness, and then he goes back and, you know, makes it look pretty again. And it's kind of an iterative process, but he's a very talented book designer.
He's amazing, and so actually I was able to contact him, and he helped me design some slide elements for my very first Pachakucha talk that I gave here in town. So, yes, yeah, so I've worked with him myself on a very limited basis. So,
all world.
This makes this book so much more exciting. So who provided all these chemical diagrams?
So the chemical diagrams, there's two phases to that. One is to get the what's called a mol file, which is sort of a 2D structure file that represents the layout of the molecule. I had an assistant, Deanna, who's at the University of Illinois, who sort of wrangled those for me. I got a bunch of them myself, and then I had her produce the rest of them. And then the question is how to render it. And, you know, you may notice they look different from most people's renderings. They have this kind of glow. So that was a piece of Mathematica code I wrote that it's basically doing kind of a bogus sort of electrostatic simulation of potential around, like if you imagine that molecule was built out of wire and had electric charges distributed on it corresponding to where the atoms and the bonds are, the glow represents the electric field strength around that, which has no physical meaning and doesn't correspond in any way to electron density in a real molecule, but it looks kind of cool. and it had sort of a smooth, organic sort of shape to it that I wanted to sort of approximate and remind people of the fact that actually the balls and sticks are complete lies, and there are no such things in molecules. There's really just soup of electrons, which are delocalized objects and don't really exist in the sense of being somewhere, and all that. But at the same time, you know, have it look recognizable as a diagram and be able to talk about the bonds and have it look pretty, and also it has to work on a black background. So there had to be some kind of a glow behind it.
But yeah, it's very aesthetically pleasing, absolutely.
And that gives me one chance to give one of my compliments for the book that I mentioned off air, which is I really appreciate the abundance of these chemical diagrams. It's hours of fun just looking at them and comparing and trying to find the shape, and putting them in without lengthy anal retentive explanations of how one is supposed to use them. Just putting them there to look at and learn from and start to understand the patterns for oneself, I think is a brilliant thing. And it seems that your publisher must be small enough that you didn't have a whole marketing department telling you you must not put equations and diagrams into your book.
Well, there is this well-accepted formula in the publishing industry that every formula you put in a book will cut its sales in half. I don't know if that applies to chemical diagrams or not, but I mean, the reason they're there, I mean, there is actually a page where I try to sort of explain, you know, how does bonding work and how do electrons work, and I have a little progression where I try to, you know, distill the reality of electron density and thick and explain why it is that we draw them this way, even though it's a total lie. But really, you know, what I was thinking is, I've always found, generally speaking, that if I kind of go with what I think is intriguing and pretty and attractive, there will be a certain number of people who also find it that way, and that's mm-hmm. the ones I'm trying to talk to. And I think these things it's just fascinating. They're like little maps of little cities, and they all have their own unique neighborhoods and characteristics, and you know, you can't really understand what's going on without looking at the map, and these are the maps, and they look nice, and in many cases you can see, you know, you can put them next to each other and you can see patterns in there. And I think this may be one reason why so many of my readers are relatively young, because you know, that's the kind of age at which people get obsessed with this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get all these emails from people, from kids, you know, six-year-olds who've memorized the periodic table all the way through, which I haven't actually done. And I'm sure there will be similar ones who are attracted to just the systematic nature of these diagrams and the fact that you can draw them and then you've captured the molecule mm-hmm. in a sense. It's like you have it in your hand, you have power over it because you've identified it and mapped it out. And I think that gives a kind of a sense of, you know, almost comfort and security about these things by having it freeze-dried like that on the page. It's no longer a mysterious thing.
And all those names in chemistry are fabulous, and you confess to being drawn to it because of that. And I'm organic chemistry is, as an outsider, a fascinating thing to me just because of those names that are so long and seem to mean something. I think that there should
be a club. Yeah, the names are fascinating. They're a window into a really remarkable achievement of being able to understand the system behind this, what seemed for thousands of years like sort of random stuff with random properties. And, you know, just like with the elements, where you can take this huge amount of empirical information about the world. You know, there's this stuff and it does this if you heat it, and it does this if you combine it with other stuff, and distill it all down into one table, and that's it. Mm-hmm. It's a complete catalog of everything, and it all fits together, it all makes sense, and there was a period of time when it was, you know, there was a transition from, we don't understand this stuff, it's very confusing, people argued about it, until, okay, now we're done. We've got this table. And you know, the situation with molecules is a little bit like that, where there was a period of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years where people knew a great deal about all of these substances but didn't understand why and didn't understand how it fits together, and that finally kind of got figured out. And, you know, it's not that by no means the end of the enterprise, but there's like now you can draw these pictures and you can say this and this are connected to this in this way, and if we use these reagents, we can, you know, redo the connections. And it all fits together in a systematic way where mm-hmm. you could tell, you know, you can place things into a system and understand them comprehensively, which is a very satisfying sort of a thing to do. And it's an example, I mean, like an example of where that isn't the case yet is with biological molecules like proteins mm-hmm. and DNA. Mm-hmm. We're right now at the stage of, like, you know, we have this code, we have a table of the DNA code, and it's really great, but, you know, 90% of most DNA, we don't actually know what it's doing. We don't really understand how it works. And there is a system there, but we don't know what that system is. And it's going to be very exciting over the next few decades as those pieces fall into place and we really kind of figure it all out. And there will then be another grand system that, you know, that will, where everything will fit together. We're kind of halfway there in the case of biological molecules.
Since you almost mentioned them, and while we're here, and then I promise to let Joanne talk again, I wondered if you would tell us a little story about Friedrich Wöhler and his synthesis of urea, and William Perkin and the synthesis of MAUVE, and why that those might get mentioned in connection with what's going on in this book. It's a rhetorical question, you know.
Yeah, so the synthesis of urea, I think, was... So at the time, and I'll get the dates wrong, so I'm not even going to try because I'm not a dates person. It was sort of in the transitional period between alchemy and chemistry, where the alchemists were, you know, people kind of make fun of them as trying to, you know, make gold from lead or whatever. But really, they were serious students of nature, and they figured out a lot of stuff, and they had a whole naming system. And, you know, they characterized the properties of many, many substances and were really the sort of the origins of the science of chemistry, was a gradual transition between alchemy and chemistry. And for a long time, even when sort of chemistry was becoming a legitimate science, people were convinced that there was just something different about organic molecules, that mm-hmm. the sort of molecules that were created by living creatures versus inorganic molecules, which, and they kind of had even though they didn't know what the stuff was, it was kind of a I know it when I see it sort of a thing, and they knew which ones were inorganic, and they knew which ones were organic, and they were convinced that only living creatures could create organic molecules, that there was a vital life force without which it was not possible. It's like you couldn't take inorganic materials and turn them into organic materials other than... you know, through living being. And this was, you know, a sort of a fundamental part of the worldview that there was a soul, a life force or some sort. Until Friedrich Wöhler came along and simply synthesized urea, which was, everyone agreed, was an organic molecule, out of inorganic molecules. And it's like, it only took one example to completely blow this entire idea out of the water. Because if you can do it with one, then, you know, who's to say you couldn't do it with others? And it took a little while for this really to kind of sink in, but it eventually was, it was the end of that worldview. The vital force and the notion that there was unique chemistry that only living things could do, it washed away, and along with it, a lot of the rest of the sort of mysticism of the alchemists, and it helped solidify the worldview based on the principle that the world is comprehensible and there's no aspects of it that aren't open to our investigation and you know, manipulation. It's a question of understanding, and there aren't these kind of mystical barriers beyond which you can't go.
So I have a question to bounce back to Nick. And the question would be, what was the most challenging substance or element to photograph? You know, I'm even looking at things like this is maybe easy, but to me, I wouldn't think it's easy to capture, you know, just the right flame or, or are you setting your studio on fire? But maybe I'm wrong that fire is not the most dangerous thing. That there was something else that was just tricky and challenging and took more shots than you thought it would.
Well, I guess there are different degrees of challenging. One of the challenges, Teo was just talking about the urea, was that Teo bought a large amount of urine specimens from basically every animal you can have a urine specimen of, and then gave them to me in this sealed container. It was kind of like, here, don't open it inside. So that was a bit of a challenge. I think otherwise, some of the actual photography-wise, some of the vitamins and the I think the vitamins were the biggest challenge because they're small, and I feel like I just spent quite a bit of time arranging them and trying to make them look nice. So the fires, we actually did those in Teo's basement to make sure we didn't set off any kind of fire alarm here, which okay. Of course we set off a fire alarm there instead. But one of the challenges was that was we needed a human hair specimen. So Teo decided to get one from his daughter, and that was a bit of a challenge too.
Yeah, that it's kind of hard to steal hair from a teenage girl. They protect it. But I needed the standard reference of something I knew for a fact was hair, because you know you can buy human hair, which is a little bit creepy, but you know, do you really know that it isn't fake? Right. And likewise, you can buy silk, and do you really know that it isn't fake? And it turns out the way you do this is by burning it, and there's this characteristically different way in which it burns. But I needed to have like a standard reference so I would know what I'm dealing with.
So there's a part in this book that I appreciate, and I think this is really important, and I'm so glad you included this. Well, you talked about this in reference to organic, but this whole idea of what's chemical free, this idea, overarching idea of chemophobia, where people are like, oh my gosh, it has chemicals, it's really bad. And you included a little bit here in reference to organic molecules, but why don't you talk about that a little bit for our audience so we can, sort of clear that up right now. There is nothing that's chemical free.
Well, yeah, I mean, except for, let's say, light. You know, if you have pure light, that doesn't have chemicals in it. But, you know, I think that one of the problems is that, and this is actually an FTC rule, it is actually legal to use the word chemical in advertising as a synonym for harmful chemical. So mm-hmm. In other words, you know, you have a package of indigo dye that says no chemicals on it, and that is okay. I mean, that shouldn't be okay, because of course it's made of chemicals. It's, you know, indigo is a chemical, and it's one of the most important chemicals in the history of chemistry, as I say in the book. But it's okay from an advertising standards point of view for them to say it has no chemicals, because it's apparently considered, everybody understands that what you mean by that is no artificially added chemicals or sort of no extra harmful chemicals put in. There's, you know, it goes unsaid that all the chemicals that were there in the first place are still there, and of course they're full of chemicals. And this is really not a helpful sort of bit of public policy. I think that, you know, the question is, like, if you can't use the word chemical to mean what it does, which is pretty much everything that anything is made of, what word can you use? I mean, if chemical is going to be redefined to mean harmful, nasty stuff that we don't like, what word have we got left to mean, you know, what chemical used to mean? And furthermore, it's not a useful way of looking at the world to say, you know, is this a synthetic chemical that's been added to something and therefore assume that it must be harmful, or, you know, this is a natural chemical that's part of the stuff to start with, and therefore it must be okay. Because the fact of the matter is that that has nothing to do with it, and there's plenty of counterexamples of, you know, there's synthetic chemicals that are great to have around, and we're very happy with them, mm-hmm. and there's natural chemicals that are quite unpleasant and that you really shouldn't have. And one of the examples, which I don't actually make clearly enough in the book, but I kind of figured out this way of talking about it, and I'm using this terminology in my talks. So I put up a crack cocaine on one side and heroin on the other side. And we have two very beautiful examples of these two things. And one of them is a natural plant extract. You know, it's like an herbal tea kind of a thing. Cocaine comes from coca leaf. It's a completely natural chemical, whereas heroin is a synthetic chemical. And I think most people can appreciate that if you're talking about like the relative merits of these two drugs and which one of them is better for you or worse for you, the fact that one is synthetic and the other is natural is completely irrelevant. It's like it's like that's not even beginning to be something that you would be concerned about in discussing which of these, you know, what, like, it just doesn't matter. It's like crack and heroin. Who cares where it came from? And yet, that is exactly the starting point for many discussions about many chemicals is, you know, first question, is it synthetic or is it natural? And based on that, you know, that's sort of the starting point for decisions about whether it's good for you or not. The word for that is prejudice. And it's, you know, it's not a helpful way of dealing with the world. You know, if you start from a prejudiced point of view, you're not going to arrive at the best decisions about what to do. And the fact is, when you get right down to it, everybody loves chemicals. And so, for example, in the book, we have a picture of asparagus, and we have a list of all the chemicals that are in it. So if you like asparagus, here's the chemicals that you like. These are the ones you like the taste of. We have, you know, a picture of vanilla extract. It's the most popular flavoring ingredient in the world. And then we've got the pictures of the chemicals that you like if you like the taste of vanilla. The principal one being vanillin. And there's several other of these substituted benzene rings that you like the taste of if you're a person who likes vanilla. And, you know...
That chapter on food molecules gave me lots of my things. And you started out there by talking about this difference that some people manage to see between food that's all natural and doesn't have any chemicals in it versus food that is manufactured and processed and is all chemicals. And you say while you're talking about the ingredient list on those processed foods that the real question isn't why these lists are so long, it's why they're so short.
Right, and yeah, because natural foods, of course, have far longer ingredient lists than processed foods.
But when you were talking about sugars, the whole thing of sugars, people can believe the most amazing things. You're talking about the adulteration of honey with high fructose corn syrup. And so here is one of my favorite quotations, at which I thought may have been the first time you used italics in the book, so I knew something important was going on. You said, whether this adulteration has occurred to a particular bottle of honey is, underlined, impossible to determine through any chemical analysis because the sugars in the two products are not distinguishable, neither by a laboratory or by your body.
Right, yeah, that was actually something I heard. That honey is basically high fructose corn syrup. They're essentially the same thing. I didn't actually know that. They're working on that.
You also said you were surprised at how much the flavor of the high fructose corn syrup seemed like honey to you when you presumed that it was going to be more the result of small impurities and things that came in the honey.
Yeah, right. I mean, of course, honey has lots of other stuff. Well, it has not lots. It has sort of small amounts of other stuff that give it color and some, you know, unique flavors because different honeys taste different. Those are not of particular nutritional significance, but they do obviously affect the flavor, and that's totally a legitimate reason to prefer honey over pure high fructose corn syrup. But it is interesting because most people have never tasted, you know, you can't buy pure high fructose corn syrup in the grocery store. You get it in, you know, in lots of different products. But if you go out and find an actual pot of it, it tastes incredibly like honey, which I was really kind of surprised. I think the real scandal though with sugars and artificial sweeteners is the fact that those little packets of Sweet and Low and things like that
are
mostly glucose. I mean, a package of Sweet and Low, which is a saccharin-based artificial sweetener, 94% glucose sugar. And the fact that it says 4 calories on the front is legal only because there's an FDA regulation that says if it's less than 5 calories, you can round down. Mm-hmm. And those packets have 4 calories of sugar in them. So, you know, this is, again, the sort of natural versus artificial. So I'm kind of diabetic a little bit, and I shouldn't eat too much sugar. And, you know, I think it's just absolutely outrageous that this packet of artificial sweetener is contaminated by a harmful, you know, dangerous to my health, natural chemical.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm
that's
diabetic.
Contaminating what should be a pure synthetic chemical that I want.
I'm diabetic by more than a little bit, so now I have to re-examine all of that. But since you just mentioned vanillin...
Oh, wait, Jeff, I just happened to find the page with these on it.
Oh, excellent, yeah.
I was just sitting here because I wanted to save the picture of the giant cookie.
Yes. That's very nice. And that's very near vanillin, and I thought we might as well, yeah. I'd like to ask for the story about whether it's the synthetic vanillin or the natural vanillin that's radioactive and why.
So that's another situation where there's, people adulterate or dilute honey with high fructose corn syrup because it's cheaper. But a far more extreme case of that is vanilla, where natural vanilla is extracted from vanilla beans. It's an incredibly labor-intensive process. They apparently have to hand pollinate the vanilla beans, there's plantations in the rainforest that have to harvest, and it's so natural vanilla extract is quite expensive. On the other hand, the vanillin molecule is a very simple one. It's very easy to synthesize from all kinds of starting points. And I bought a pound or maybe it was even a kilogram of pure vanilla for a few dollars on eBay. It's the stuff is absolutely dirt cheap. So there's a tremendous temptation. Oh, and it's chemically exactly the same. It's literally the same molecule that is the principal flavor ingredient in natural vanilla versus synthetic vanilla. So, companies can add any amount of synthetic vanilla and sell it as natural vanilla, and nobody can tell. There's absolutely no way to tell, except radiocarbon dating, essentially. Synthetic vanilla, it actually used to be made of wood, and then you really couldn't tell, but it's currently made almost entirely from petroleum feedstocks, from stuff which ultimately came from oil. And oil is plant material, but it's very, very old plant material. So the way carbon-14 dating, radiocarbon dating, works is that radioactive carbon-14 from the atmosphere is incorporated by plants. They grow in the air. They build that CO2, the carbon, into their tissues, and it then decays very slowly. And so oil is very old, and so all the carbon-14 has completely decayed. And synthetic vanilla is therefore not radioactive. Whereas natural vanilla, it came from plants that grew, last year or something. So its age is very young, and it therefore contains still pretty much all of the carbon-14 that it got from the atmosphere, and is therefore radioactive to a completely insignificant degree, and basically to the same degree that every single thing that you eat, everything that grew, whether it's a plant or an animal, that you eat, is radioactive with carbon-14. It's not, the slightest bit a health concern. But nevertheless, it's radioactive, and you can measure that, and that is apparently used in detecting, vanilla fraud by looking at whether it's radioactive or count as natural.
Interesting. I'm going to go back to Nick a minute. There's so many questions I have. So I'm actually looking at, we did talk about dyes already and about, the issue of color. How did you do this? Is this actually the glass up against the white background with liquid, or is there some sort of process?
Mostly, yeah. I actually take particular pride in how well those came out.
They're really nice.
And when I think the app comes out, if you have that, you'll be able to watch the video of the dye stripping in, which I think will also look nice. But yeah, it's I just very carefully had a setup with a white background and I had black tape that I very carefully taped out the outline of the glass. And then when the glass is filled with water, that distorts and bends the light around so you can't see the sharp outline of the tape. I think they came out very well. I'm quite happy with that.
Yeah, I was impressed with that. Oh, you've got more. Yeah.
Well, this should be video now. If I can get the reflection to go away.
So right now, Teo's holding the app in progress. It's not available yet, right?
Yep, not available yet. But you should be seeing that animating. I can't really...
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, we can see that.
Every one of those is a video of it dropping in there. And just had a syringe that I was filling up. It's actually very strong dye, so I think I accidentally dyed some plastic tables and some other things while I was working.
Yeah, we have a colorful set of tabletops now.
Yes, it's, everything's very colorful.
There was actually another related one, which I'll see if I can find the video, which is we also used dye for that was even more exciting, which is these tranquilizer darts.
Oh.
Oh, yes, at about how quickly they inject with their explosive plungers.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I can find the video of that. It's should be coming up here in a moment.
So while Teo's looking at for this, I just wanted to let people know that I showed you the book, The Elements, and book Molecules, but we have had a past guest, Marcus Chown, and he did a book from the same publisher, same format, called The Solar System, and he also had an app. And all of the apps, The Elements and The Solar System, are very well recognized for being excellent apps. And so if you have those two, I'm sure you're looking forward to the one that comes out for the molecules. So,
So here's a video of, and basically these are, they're like blowgun darts, which it turns out you can just order these. Like there's no restrictions on them because they come without any tranquilizer in them. They're just empty. But they have a kind of an explosive charge. It's like a little cap in the back, and you can blow them out of a blowgun or a CO2 rifle or something. And we just use the tube. That this maybe Nick is actually getting one.
yes, we have some of them here. You can see.
Yeah, so they're really cool. They have a weight in the back with a little spring, and then there's a cap, and then there's a plunger. And so you blow it. When it hits the animal, there's a needle with a barb, a nasty-looking barb. The needle goes in. That's got the little plastic barb thing. Some of them have little wire barbs. And then it stops suddenly, and so the weight keeps traveling. And it hits the cap, and that ignites a little charge. And
I don't know how well you can see that, but that's what the back of it looks like.
Yeah, I don't know if you can kind of make out. There's the weight and the spring. Anyway, and so then there's this explosion, and in a hundredth of a second or less, the entire contents of the syringe are injected, that just must hurt, I think, a lot. You got this giant.
You don't recognize it at the moment.
And so we photographed this by setting up a tank of water and filling the dart with just a dye instead of actual tranquilizer. And shooting it straight down into a kind of a barrier. That took like all day. There was a lot of tries. And the explosive force is pretty good. Like when it's like a rocket because it jets out, it shoots the water out, and it's kind of like one of those pop can rockets. So when the barb failed sometimes, the thing would come shooting back out again and hit the ceiling, spraying colored dye all over.
So when we were doing this, Teo was the one with the blow dart or with the blowgun pointing straight down. And so when it would fly back up, there would be a very sharp pointy thing flying back up very close to him. And that was
I think I actually wore goggles that time. I think even I kind of
Yeah. You wore goggles after the first time.
Yeah.
That'll change things very quickly. And even when you were talking about cocaine and heroin, you're getting your hands on controlled substances.
There's different ways of photographing this kind of stuff. It's same with elements too. There's kind of there's things that you sort of corners of the world that you end up with you need to have this stuff because it's part of the world, and I don't really believe in burying my head in the sand about the existence of these substances. I get a certain amount of flack in talking about things that some people think one shouldn't talk about, especially with kids. I completely reject that worldview. I think it's important to talk about them, especially with kids, and it's important to recognize that they exist and that they are chemicals also.
Yes.
And that they have properties and that they should be looked at. I mean, cocaine is a great example where, it's for years, for generations, was considered a great thing. It was the first dental anesthetic, and dentistry was completely revolutionized by cocaine. And in South America, the tea you buy it, there's coca leaf and coca tea in the book, which, I just happened to have some friends who'd been in Peru recently and bought it in a tourist shop and brought it back. Mm-hmm. It's like the most ordinary thing. I mean, here we freak out about it, but in other parts of the world, it's just like herbal tea. It's nothing special. It doesn't cause any great trouble. But you take it and you transplant it into a different society, into a different social system, and you learn how to cook it into crack cocaine, and all of a sudden you have a massive societal problem coming from what in other parts of the world is just an herbal tea. And it's often very subtle differences. Like for example, I love the example of ephedrine, which for quite a while here, until quite recently, was a legal herbal supplement that many people took, kind of like echinacea or whatever, except it's ephedra. It comes from a plant people made tea about out of it. And it was eventually decided by the regulatory authorities that this was a bad idea, and so they banned it. And so you can no longer buy ephedra tea, but you can buy Sudafed as an over-the-counter, almost over-the-counter cold medicine. And it's almost indistinguishable. So I have in the book, I have both ephedra and Sudafed and methamphetamine, because it turns out that both of those are incredibly close chemically to methamphetamine, which is, a highly regulated substance and not something you want to get involved with. The differences are very subtle, and some of them are chemical and some of them are sort of societal in terms of which substances end up being abused.
Right. So speaking of, you talked for a little bit about, the names and organization of molecules, but you explained in the beginning of the book that you had to come up with a way to organize this book, to have it make sense to you, or a way to present this, because it is sort of hard to just present molecules.
Right. Well, there's too many of them. The beautiful thing about the book about elements is that there's exactly 118 that fit in the standard table. Like, my table of contents is predetermined 100 years ago. Well, not quite, but it's like all I have to do is write about each one of these, and I'll be done. And that's half the challenge of a book. That's one of the reasons why it took so long to get around to doing a molecules book. Because every time I thought about it, it's like, this is completely overwhelming. How can I possibly even start writing about this topic? There's 35 million compounds in ChemSpider, which is kind of one of these big online databases that, and every one of them has a name and a chemical structure and properties that have been measured. And, there's that's not the end of it. There's many more that haven't yet been named and studied. There's sort of an infinite number. That's an intimidating problem. Plus, they're all white powders, which, I wasn't quite sure what to do about that either. And I finally realized was that the fact that it was completely impossible to be comprehensive, even to cover all the categories, would be unrealistic. What that meant is that I could just pick and choose and do, the ones that I thought were interesting and try to kind of, put together a set of chapters that, each chapter kind of hangs together and has a certain point to it. And where overall I felt like, gives you a flavor of what chemistry is like, and not feel bad about the fact that it wasn't complete. I mean, like, so we have vitamins in there, but we don't have antibiotics.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We actually bought a bunch, it's like, did you know you can buy pure tetracycline on eBay?
not surprised.
Just order it. It's kind of scary. So we got a bunch of antibiotics and ended up just like, now we've got it on the line somewhere. And it was a sense of freedom, actually, to know that I'll never be complete. No way that it can ever cover everything.
So you could do molecules too, right?
Mm-hmm. You could do an infinite number. The one place where I kind of, the very last chapter, I think it's called Machines of Life.
Machines of Life, I've got
it. And it's basically, what it is essentially is punting on proteins and DNA.
Right.
It's a short chapter, and it doesn't have any molecular diagrams. And basically what it says is that, well, yes, technically molecules, proteins and DNA, they are molecules, but they really aren't molecules in the same sense the rest of the ones in the book are, because you don't use the same language and you don't use the same ways of thinking about them as you do with the smaller molecules that are in the rest of the book. You think about them more like information processing machinery. Mm-hmm. There's a code. It's much more computer-like. It's more like programming than it is like chemistry in many ways. Of course, the implementation of those machines is through chemistry, and there are people who study it at the chemical level, but it's kind of like you're up a step. You're really dealing with another level, a meta level on top of the molecular level, which is, you know, the way that you need to talk about them for it to make the most sense. And that's a whole other book, which may or may not. I mean, the next book I'm going to work on is reactions.
I was going to ask, what's the next book?
Right. Well, it's, you know, elements, molecules, reactions. It'll be a box set, you know, I'm sure at some point, and it's those, those three. They go together, and they are the three branches of, you know, of how to think about chemistry. And since you know, as soon as I started working on elements, I was thinking there are three books here. They go together, and you know, it'll be, I don't know, 8 years or something until that set is finished. But then there would be a sensible fourth one to be sort of mega molecule, you know, molecules of life. That would, I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but that would be a, you know, a good book to do after reactions, I think.
Well, this is Nick employed for a while.
This is a good chance for me to make one more little compliment and then do one other little thing that I wanted to do before we're done. The compliment is that this book probably has the most amazing collection of phrases and words in its index that I've ever seen in an index. And I thought that was pretty fabulous. I really appreciate looking at the index and seeing all the things that I can look up. It's pretty remarkable. And then, Joanne, I don't think we've ever done a survey, but while we have the four of us here, I wanted to find out how many of us can smell asparagus pea.
Oh.
I can. Yeah.
I can.
And I can.
I don't actually know.
Okay, so this is pretty good. Three out of four with a maybe. Okay.
Well, eat some asparagus.
Yeah.
Right.
You'll know.
I've never noticed it before, so maybe not.
Might not. So, interestingly, one thing I want to mention, we're winding down and I want to have you guys say some last words, but if you guys are familiar at all with Tao's sense of humor, you'll love his book, because there's always just interesting wry phrases, and, you know, it's in a way, it's like, hey, this is serious science, but let's not take ourselves way too seriously, you know, destroying the atmosphere for fun and profit. Now, come on. You know what I mean? Like, if you were going to be
the sodium duck, I thought, was a great example of that.
Yeah, there's lots of little phrases, oh, we're just putting this in here just because. You know, so it's like, it's just a lot of fun.
Did you find the joke in the knitting section?
I missed that. I haven't.
And there's a wool. There's a. It's my favorite joke in the whole book. I don't know if I should give it away or not, but there's a.
I'm sure I read it because I pay attention to the fiber arts things, but now I'm trying to remember what.
Well,
we
so
might
there's read. A an example of locally grown wool, that. It's like, so I wanted to have a sheep knitted out of wool. I thought that would be kind of cool. And so it turns out that my girlfriend Nina's mom is an avid knitter. And so she started working on knitting a sheep for me.
Oh, yes. You don't have to give it away. I did see it, and I made some note someplace, but you can give it away if you want. But it was exceedingly funny example.
Right. Well, I'll give it away because I read somewhere that people hate it when authors don't like try to be coy and refuse to like say something that's in their book as a crass attempt to get people to buy it. So she started working on this sheep and started knitting the sheep and gave up after having knitted only the rear end of the sheep. I don't know, if one of you have the book there, maybe you can read the end of that caption.
But it's where you say this is the only book that has a knitted sheep butt.
Well, it's what it says. I think it says the situation we're dealing with here is that we have photographed a knitted sheep's butt and put it in a book.
Yes.
which is, in fact, the situation, because that's what I had to work with. I had a knitted sheep's butt, and that's all I had. And, you know, we didn't know what else to do with it.
But, you know, I didn't look to see if knitted sheep's butt was in the index, and I really should have checked that.
Well, okay, so we are at the top of the hour. We don't have advertisers telling us to right now, but we would like to wrap things up. And the way we like to do that is actually to ask our guests if they have anything else to add or maybe mention something you were hoping we would ask. So why don't we start with Nick, and then we'll wrap it up with Tao.
I think the only thing I have to add is I hope you enjoy the book, and please read it, because my friends all pick up the book and they kind of glance through and they're like, wow, this is so beautiful. And I'm like, thank you. But Taya was an excellent author and reading, so I hope you enjoy it, and please actually read it.
It's great. It's great information. Taya.
Well, I guess I'll go with the crass emotionalism and say, buy my book, and when the app comes out, you should get the app, too. It's not really an either-or question. You need to get both of them if you have an iPad, and give it to all your friends and relatives and kids for Christmas.
Yep, Christmas gifts. This right here, Christmas gifts.
Yeah, and Christmas Elements book. And so periodical.com, and I actually have a blog now. If you go to theodoregray.com, it used to be really crappy, but now it's slightly better, and I have an actual blog. And, for example, you can see a picture of a cat that was named after me by a fan recently, which is kind of fun, and other such things at theodoregray.com.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. I love your books. We'll always be a fan, and I look forward to, you know, however many more years it takes, but looking forward to the next one. And, Jeff, as always, it's great to have you as you know, here helping ask questions and coming up with great great topics to talk about with our guests.
Thanks, Joanne. Thanks, Nick. Thanks, Teo, so much for telling us about your book and telling us interesting stories today.
And thanks to all of you who are watching, and we'll join you again in the near future with another guest on Read Science.
Thanks for having me.